You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Paul Mason is a brain injury caseworker, and his debut book, Head Cases, recounts his experiences helping patients and their families deal with this catastrophic event. The statistics are staggering. 5,300,000 Americans live with a permanent disability from a brain injury, and each year nearly 1.5 million people sustain one. 50,000 of those die from an injury each year. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and it brings Michael Paul Mason back to the show today. Hello.
Hi. Hi, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
What exactly is the job of a head injury caseworker?
Well, typically what happens with most brain injury case managers is that they work on the discharge planning. So they're helping a patient at a facility find the next place to go from there. I worked sort of in reverse. I would go out, do clinical evaluations all over the U.S. and try to help them get into a place. Sometimes it was the hospital that I worked for in Tulsa. Most of the time it was usually another facility, or I would simply fail at getting them placement.
Do you know how many case managers there are relative to the number of brain injuries?
I believe the Case Management Society of America released a figure a few years ago saying that there were 20,000 case managers in the U.S., but there are only 250 brain injury case managers.
So we're talking about 250 for, what did I say, 5,300,000 Americans living with this problem?
That's correct. And you know, new figures coming out are saying that there are 125,000 severe injuries a year.
How many hospitals are equipped to rehabilitate people who have brain injuries?
Well, my estimate is that there's between 3,000 to 5,000what's called post-acute brain injury beds, which is that phase of treatment that people need after the acute stay in the hospital.
How long do they tend to stay?
Recommended times vary from about 3 months to several years, depending on the severity of injury.
And what level of injury does a person have to employ a case manager?
Well, it's got to interrupt daily functioning, so it prohibits the person from being able to do their job or, have a functional relationship in their family or that sort of thing.
You said that there are very few brain injury case managers. Is that because this is not a job people want to have?
Well, I think that's a component of it. And another, aspect of it is that traditionally there's just a poverty of brain injury services and programs nationwide. Most of these brain injury survivors have been relegated to mental health institutions or, other.
So they're put in with the mentally ill, even though they're not mentally ill.
Yeah, I would say at least half of my evaluations occurred in mental health settings.
And do you have to have special training for this?
I actually have an undergrad in English literature. So
that sounds like good training for brain injuries.
But I am a certified brain injury specialist, which is, a specialization in the injury itself.
What are the most typical causes for brain injuries?
Well, there are a lot of falls among the elderly, and of course, car accidents are a really big one for, the adult demographic. For children, it's a little bit different. A lot of biking injuries, sports-related injuries, and the more acquired side of injuries like brain tumors.
But isn't the brain pretty well protected by the skull? And haven't we implemented all sorts of safety features like helmets, airbags, seatbelts that should be protecting us against these things?
Well, sure, but as the Iraq War has kind of demonstrated, even the best prevention methods fall short of actually taking care of it.
But I'm not threatened by an IED every time I get into a car.
That's true, but you are vulnerable to blunt trauma. I believe earlier you were telling me a little bit about having a bike wreck yourself, and
I should have been wearing a helmet.
That's right.
My guest is Michael Paul Mason, whose book Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath has gotten fabulous reviews.
Thank you.
Congratulations, the New York Times and mm-hmm. other publications. There's a chapter where you evaluate your own history with various kinds of brain trauma. Mm-hmm. Would you say that yours is a typical history?
Yeah, I'd say that most people, have had, a slew of minor assaults, ranging from, bumps on the head. I had a skateboarding accident when I was young, and, it fell on my forehead, and, I write about a number of different things that I've done to my brain, and I think each of them have had, a level of effect,
even someone though, you can't find the car keys or
sometimes I think
can't remember a name. Boy, it was because that time I fell down.
I just noticed that my brain's not able to do some of the things with the same agility that it used to be able to do.
Of course, people used to just call those senior moments.
I should be having them at 36.
Don't much of what we now know about the human brain, doesn't much of it come from studies of people with brain injuries?
Yeah, a tremendous amount does. However, I like to tell people that even with the amount of knowledge that we have about the brain, if the brain is its own internal universe, we've only just made it to the moon. There's so much that we still do not understand.
Even though we started learning about it way back in the 19th century, 1860s, with a French surgeon named Paul Broca.
Right, yeah. It's an incredibly complex organ, and so it's a testament to that complexity that we know so little, but yet we're making such tremendous strides that I expect we'll see unexpected and really fantastic research coming.
Well, we knew so little about the brain that we would operate on it with prefrontal lobotomies.
Essentially causing new injuries.
Using, I think they used apple cores. And then there was that famous case in the 50s where surgeons removed both temporal lobes from an epilepsy patient, and that left him without a hippocampus. Mm-hmm. And that meant he had was unable to acquire new memories. And that I think we probably talked about that case than once on this show.
Yeah.
But they didn't know, and they just were... In the 50s, it was still just experimenting that way?
Right, yeah, that's true. I mean, we look at it as fairly inhumane, and, I wonder what people 100 years from now are going to think about the methods that we employ now. We are still, needing to, for example, resection brains, cutting off entire lobes in order to prevent, say, the spread of a tumor.
Mm. And we cut that off with the idea that we may lose something, but we're also gaining something?
Well, I don't know that it's thought that it's gaining anything.
You're saving
rather
life.
Just simply impeding. Yeah, you're saving life, you're impeding progress, and a lot of times it's also maybe decreasing seizure activity.
Although brain tumors can also lead to all sorts of strange behavior. Mm-hmm. I remember Pagene Fitzgerald, who was my co-host on the show, she said that she knew that something was up with her husband when he started saying weird things, and turned out it was because he had a brain tumor.
Yeah, that's right. I write about a child with a brain tumor in the book, and he ends up becoming one of the most violent children in America as a result. Very sweet young boy, just goes into rages as a result of it.
And how was that treated?
He had a good portion of his temporal lobe resectioned in surgery, and it helped diminish the impairment in some capacity, but it also created a lot of other cognitive problems as a result.
Although that seems to be the case in almost every instance in your book. The first one is that of a snowboarder named Cheyenne Emmerich. Given the job you've had and the kinds of problems you've seen over the years, are you opposed to snowboarding now and drinking and engaging in contact sports?
Yeah, well, you put those three things together, and yeah, I'm very opposed to that. But, snowboarding alone, no, I think if the person can, check themselves, not engage in overly risky behavior and do a really great job at protecting their head, then, more power to them.
But in the case of Cheyenne, he was an extraordinarily good snowboarder. I'm sure he did all the things he had to do to protect himself.
Yeah, he miscalculated a jump in very poor conditions and was riding too aggressively and just, really, took a hard hit.
Aren't they used to falling?
he was very used to falling. He had suffered a number of different injuries to various parts of his body, but one injury in particular did him in. It ended up giving him a seizure disorder where he now sustains 120 seizures a month, several of them grand mals.
But interestingly, he was unaware of it for at least a year and a half.
Right. Prior to his grand mal seizure, he sustained these absence seizures daily. But he had, you know, he had walked away from the accident, and so he thought that he was just simply having anxiety attacks, or just strange episodic moments. And he thought that he might have been losing his mind at some points because his interior life was so so chaotic. But he didn't connect it to that actual injury until, you know, the CAT scan showed that lesion on his brain.
What is a brain seizure? How does it manifest itself?
Well, it's an irregular electrical activity in the brain. So it manifests itself at different severities. You know, a minor one could simply appear as though, you know, the person is just kind of spaced out or daydreaming. But when it goes up to the grand mal level of seizure, the person will, you know, lose consciousness. Their eyes will roll in the back of their head. Their body will contort in all various kinds of positions. It's a very frightening thing because that's an injury that could create a seizure loop known as status epilepticus. And if the brain cannot get out of a seizure, then it's a very serious condition.
So in some cases, we won't even know whether someone's having a seizure. But then when it gets to one of the more extreme levels, it's quite apparent. Does a person who hasn't suffered brain trauma ever experience anything similar?
You can have those different types of experiences from different causes outside of trauma, but a lot, you know, they're always somehow neurologically related.
You don't speculate in the book, but would it have made any difference if he'd gone for treatment immediately?
I believe it would have made a significant amount of difference if he had, you know, caught it earlier, because I think physicians would have been able to slow down seizure activity.
Well, we see football players who regularly suffer brain trauma. Mm-hmm. Some return. Some say, you know, I can't return because it will cause irreparable damage.
Right.
But they're all wearing helmets, in fact, rather good protective helmets.
Yeah, but they're also exposing themselves to forces that, you know, pretty uncommon. Very, very extreme blunt force trauma to the head. So, you know, their brain is going from a very fast velocity to a very slow, you know, immediate stop. And that impact can really cause some problems.
My guest is Michael Paul Mason, and his book, Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. By the way, we've posted a link to a Please Explain segment we did last year on traumatic brain injury. So you can check that out by going to our show page at WNYC.org if you want to hear more about the topic. But you won't be hearing about some of the fascinating cases that Michael Paul Mason has laid out in his book. So stay with us for more of that. We're back with Michael Paul Mason, who is a brain injury case manager based in Tulsa, Oklahoma, although he travels all over the country. And he's written a book called Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Would you say that people are generally ignorant about brain trauma?
Very uneducated about the, you know, the lifelong and impact of brain trauma.
What about the typical GP or pediatrician? Are they usually able to recognize and treat brain injuries?
I don't think that the typical one fully appreciates the complex nature of the injury. I think it's often underestimated.
And then, as in the case with Cheyenne, he felt that there was no reason to go to a doctor to even have it checked out.
Right, yeah.
It wasn't until he had an MRI that he finally found out what had gone on.
Yeah, it's true. I could tell you hundreds of stories of people that have called me with, you know, just sort of tying in their injury into their life changes, that they've, you know, suddenly realized that, you know, this fall down the stairs actually did have an effect on them.
But the neurologist who diagnosed Cheyenne seems peculiarly unsuited to be dealing with people in this position. Is he typical? Or?
Well, in the experiences that I've had, the neurologist is usually solely interested in, you know, in the brain and taking care of it, you know, not so much, they don't feel a tremendous amount of responsibility for what happens in the person's life outside of the doctor's office.
One of the doctors told a mother that if he'd seen her son in Vietnam, he'd have left him in a ditch to die.
Yeah, that's true.
That doesn't seem like a good bedside manner.
No, not typical.
I always thought that they were taught to do, to be a bit more sensitive.
Yeah.
Can drugs treat brain seizures?
Yeah, there are medications that do treat seizure activity. However, some of them come at the cost of, you know, maybe some sort of cognitive cloudiness and or, you know, stupor and that kind of thing. So many people who are on those drugs don't like to take them.
And does it limit their activities? If you're on one of those drugs, are you less likely to be able to drive a car?
Oh, yeah. You're not. If you have epilepsy, you're not supposed to drive a car.
Are there any exercises you can do?
Well, with regards to seizure activity, what you're supposed to do is, pay attention to whatever is triggering that seizure. It's usually an external situation, and avoid that. You know.
On television, when somebody has a seizure, the first thing they do is they pull out his tongue so he won't swallow it.
Yeah, that's not proper protocol. You're actually supposed to roll them over on the side. Sticking your fingers in a seizing person's mouth can actually result in getting your fingers bitten off.
Cheyenne tried his hand at acting, and it seemed that he didn't have any seizures while he was performing. Is that typical?
Yeah, he was oddly able to stave them off, which shows, you know, the complicated side of seizure activity, where, you know, the question, you know, becomes, does the brain, find a way to redirect the seizure activity or displace it for a little time when it really needs to.
Well, we've heard many people who've had strokes and then their brains just rearranged themselves.
Right,
and
yeah.
They came back pretty much as good as they were. And other people just cannot recover. Is it because of where the trauma takes place?
That has a great amount to do with it. Also, the type of rehabilitation, or if the person is able to get rehabilitation following that injury, because the brain basically has to be taught to, you know, create these new neural pathways that allow the person to regain losses that they sustained.
Is there any theory that this kind of experience extends a person's consciousness in a beneficial way?
I have heard of a few cases and have met a few individuals where they feel like their injury has somehow enhanced their lives or gave them a greater sense of fulfillment. But it also comes with the reality of, you know, some kind of cognitive impairment. They may not be able to do something that they were able to do, but they develop an appreciation for their life as a result of it.
I've heard a theory that St. Paul was thrown from his horse on the way to Damascus because of a seizure, not because of an act of God, although the others would say, well, the seizure was an act of God.
Yeah, I do write about several figures that are mystics that were alleged to have epilepsy or some kind of seizure activity.
Does this sort of work, lead you to be more wary of just riding in a car? Would you ever go rollerblading?
Oh, I'm much more cautious than I used to be, and it has had an effect on me. In Oklahoma, where I'm from, we don't have helmet laws, and occasionally I'll see a motorcyclist zooming down the highway without a helmet, and I actually have a gag reflex when I see that because I've assessed so many people from motorcycle accidents.
What kind of effect? You have to deal with the families as well, don't
That's
you?
That's right, yeah.
How do they deal with this?
It is a catastrophic injury for a reason. It just sort of reverberates throughout the family. It tears them apart, throws them into financial crisis.
You're talking about $1,000 a day in a hospital?
Yeah, that's on the less expensive side of treatment. I would say it averages around $1,500 to $1,700 a day for treatment that should, you know, be happening for months and months at a time. And this is
so we're talking millions of dollars.
Millions. I want to say that the average lifetime cost for a civilian injury is 3 to 5 million. And the cost for an Iraq war veteran's injuries, which usually comes with polytrauma, you know, something else in the body is, injured as well. Cost of that is 15 to 20 million over the lifetime.
You talk about Iraq in this book and the treatments that take place in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. Have they become the world's foremost experts on brain trauma?
Yeah, at the at the acute phase of injury, nobody does a better job than the military. You stand a much higher chance of survival in Iraq than you do in the U.S.
My guest is Michael Paul Mason. His book, Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. We were talking about families. You have to admire a parent like Kathy Rabe, whose son's injury and her involvement in this treatment resulted in vast changes throughout her state, Iowa.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
How did her son, Rob, get hurt?
Rob was injured in a motor vehicle accident. A drunk driver basically caused it. And Kathy Herring is actually her last name, was able to sort of champion for her son's care. And this was in the early 80s, I believe. And so he actually had about 2 years worth of rehabilitation, which today is unheard of. And it was paid for by insurance.
And he's able to recall the story of his traumatic injury. Isn't that unusual?
Yeah, it is unusual, and he's able to recall it vividly. He basically had a very specific injury to his brainstem that resulted in severe motor impairment.
What they call locked-in syndrome?
He was locked in as a result of that injury for some time. I believe it was more than a month or so. And so he could communicate with eye blinks, but that was it.
And that's how you can tell the difference between what he was going through and a persistent vegetative state?
Well, there's a lot of reclassification going on, and persistent vegetative state is a very hot topic right now as to what is actually happening in that state. So a lot of people are saying, it's some kind of minimally conscious state, and they just don't know how much awareness a person has in that.
Well, can't they just check out the brain waves? I mean, isn't that what they did with Terry Schiavo?
Yeah, they do, and they attempt to understand it. But even after Terry Schiavo's case, there have been some recent findings that indicate that, there's some activity there. They just don't know to what degree that's purposeful.
In Rob's case, his nurse seems to have been better for him than his doctors.
That's true. She was a real advocate for him, and she made a tremendous difference in his recovery.
When you ask Rob what the outcome would be if he were injured today, he replies that he would die.
That's true, because he's the director of a rehab, and so he deals with insurance, and he knows that insurance today would simply not provide for that level of care that it once did in the 80s. And without that level of care, he would have died.
So we'd like to believe that science continues to improve.
Right, but if you can't access those improvements, that's a bit of a problem.
One of the cases you examine is a girl named Asia, I guess.
Yeah, Asia Schwinn.
She's a 25-year-old woman with two master's degrees, a doctorate in math, a career as an artist. And sounds to me like she's done okay.
Yeah, she's done very well. She's a very unique individual. And she had her injury at a fairly young age. She was 12 years old at the time of her bicycle injury. And that's her recovery in part is a testament to just how well a young person's brain can recover. She has tremendous success, not as a result of her injury, but rather as a way of integrating her injury into her life.
Although she could have even gotten to the hospital earlier if her pediatrician, who also happened to be her aunt, hadn't told the family, well, we can wait till tomorrow.
Right, that's true. They told her to just ride out the vomiting and the blurred vision, and if she could just stay conscious that she would be okay.
Now, she was treated in Russia, I guess, during the Soviet period?
Yes, that's correct.
Was her treatment better because they had full medical care there, or was it as poor as
It's as poor as anywhere else in the world, because there's no standardization of care, no guidelines for treatment that anybody really follows. And so her parents were actually very skeptical about treatment at that Russian hospital, and so they pulled her out early, even though the doctors had not recommended that.
How did the Central Park jogger case result in improvement in treatment for head injuries?
Well, it somehow inspired George Soros to endow the Brain Trauma Foundation with some money to help establish greater research and some level of guidelines for the care of pediatric patients throughout the world. So,
I mean, George Soros is not the evil man that conservatives say he is. He actually does some good.
Apparently, not purely evil.
And what's the Brain Trauma Foundation?
It's an organization that helps promote education of brain injury and practice and treatment.
Trish Melfi, the jogger, was as brutally injured as anyone could imagine, and yet she has been on this show, and her recovery seems rather remarkable.
Yeah, it is remarkable, and I think that part of that is due to the rally of individuals around her that help sustain her. That's usually what a brain injury survivor requires, is a lot of support from family and friends to help them get through their recovery.
Now, not all of the brain problems are from trauma. You wrote about a man who, after a herpes infection spread to his brain, regularly became convinced that he's dead.
That's true, and that's a particularly scary type of brain injury. This herpes virus that many of us show as a fever blister. That virus can reside in the body, and occasionally it will cross that brain-blood barrier and cause an infection in the brain, causing it to swell. And if it swells, you're in a sad state of affairs very quickly.
And there's no way to know whether that's going to happen or not?
No. It seems to happen in times of great stress and low immunity. And so in this particular case, he was a very hardworking guy, and it masqueraded as a flu. And the flu went away, and then he started having these slight olfactory hallucinations, and soon began a precipitous decline.
You talked earlier about a kid who had a brain tumor who acted violently, but violence comes in all sorts of different ways. In fact, Asia, the high achiever, would have seizures and awaken clutching a handful of somebody else's hair.
That's right. Agitation, aggression are common symptoms or results, I should say, of certain types of brain injuries. And so what's thought to occur is that the brain loses its ability to check those kinds of responses. And so people act out on agitation.
Now, I mentioned earlier that Rob's mother had a real effect on Iowa. Is Iowa the place to be if you have a brain injury?
It is. I often tell people that if I ever sustain a brain injury, get me to Iowa as quickly as possible, because they are probably the most proactive state that I'm aware of that really does a tremendous job at taking care of their own. They will fund people that have no insurance and that type of thing.
So the state laws changed because of a celebrated case. And as we mentioned, the Central Park jogger had an impact as well. I guess the other thing is to make the newspaper headlines.
Right. I often encourage family members to contact the press in the event that they're having difficulties getting recognition for the challenges that they're facing.
I'm hoping that this book will be read by lots more people in the medical profession. There are good doctors out there, doctors who really do a fabulous job.
Oh, yeah, many caring and compassionate people across a variety of positions.
And there are more people being aware of this. In fact, a listener sent me information about a play that is opening in New York called A Rope in the Abyss, which is about brain trauma. And they say, if you liked the diving bell and the butterfly and away from her, you'll love a rope in the abyss. Well, until people know more about this, we will continue to have problems, won't we? If what would you recommend if somebody falls off of a bike or thinks that little bump in the car may have caused maybe some problem with their neck, but not much else?
If they're functioning okay, but they feel as though there's something the matter, either go directly to a neurologist or get a full-blown neuropsychological evaluation done, which will detail any cognitive impairments that might have occurred.
For example, a caller has said that, I don't know if it's a he or a she, fell and developed vertigo. Would that be indicative?
That's very common of a brain injury.
So that person should go to a doctor
immediately. That's very treatable, too. So the caller should have some hope.
And we thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate your interest in this.
Michael Paul Mason's book, Head Cases, Stories of Brain Injury and Its Aftermath, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux.